which we've been thinking about entrenchment for a while. Now, this work was something mostly at backward talk at the very end of May used that term. And this part of this work was done with collaboration with Paul Landecker, who is at the Institute at the moment, Gil Paz, who is the postdoc of the Institute, and Yan Tao Wang, who is a faculty at Princeton. And you can find a short version of this work on at the So, this talk will be rather technical, so if I'm saying something, if I'm using some buzzwords if you're not familiar with, using some terminology or notations that you're not following, please do stop me, I'll be happy to explain. Because really the model is rather simple, and the assumptions going into it are fairly straightforward, and it leads to some very striking predictions that they say, which is eventually what we are. So, let me just start with a little motivation. The motivation for this talk is rather different than the usual motivation you hear when you listen to phenomenology talks. Usually, people start with the hierarchy problem. We need some new physics at the electroweak scale, and you go from there. You're basically trying to solve a fine-tuning problem. Now, this talk is going to be taking it in completely different directions. We're motivated by the fact by two striking general features of quantum descriptions of gravity. One of them is, of course, the existence of supersymmetry, and the other are additional abelian groups, abelian gate groups. So this is the motivation for this talk, and we try to understand whether there is any intimate connection between these two features. Now, the problem that we have as physicists with these two features is that none of them is observed in nature. We don't see an additional force. This would be an additional force. And we don't see supersymmetry. So supersymmetry is broken, and so is this additional gate. Now, we know enough about supersymmetry. You know that if we imagine that our spinal model is somehow supersymmetric, the breaking of supersymmetry cannot be done within this sector, at least not perturbatively. So this led people to believe that if supersymmetry is really there, there must be some hidden sector that does the supersymmetry break, whether dynamically or perturbatively. That sector is supposed to break supersymmetry. Now, what I mean by hidden? By hidden, I mean that it has no renormalizable interactions with the spinal model fields. Okay? But I can, for example, have some extra U, abelian U1 gauge group communicating between these two sectors. Okay? And the language of supersymmetry, this will be some vector superfield, which throughout this talk I will denote as Z1. Okay? So this is the basic picture for this talk. And let me just quickly go to what I want to tell you in this talk. I would like to tell you about what it means, what it implies to have vector mediation. And this is a basic picture for this section. Second, I'd like to tell you about the quantum dynamics that emerge from this construction. It turns out that there are very, very interesting dynamics that that create all the low energy phenomena. Lastly, I'd like to tell you about phenomenology, which is fairly striking. And I probably won't have time, but if you want to hear about it, I can tell you why is it actually very natural to have that in brain constructions. So brain constructions, and this is work we have done with Herman Berlinde, turns out to be extremely natural environments to have exactly that. There's only a topological requirement on your ability to do it. So are there any questions on what is this all going to cover?
So why do we need those things to be vectors, say, rather than scalars?
This one?
Yeah.
I don't need to. In fact, most of one of the most successful models for mediation actually involves the chiral superfields, which are scalars together with fermions.
Okay.
I would assume that this is a mediator.
And why do they have to be a mediator?
So abelian comes for many reasons. First of all, from the string point of view, it's very hard to have an unabelian such an unabelian mediation. I will try to talk about it in here if I get to it. Second is the simplest example. We know of many unified field theories in the Gatsky that have those extra abelian groups, and it's just a simple thing to work with.
Well, thanks.
Because Zen prime is like a fifth force.
That's right. So if you don't like this talking about the abelian groups, just think about it's a fifth force.
But why do you have to break the symmetry? Because maybe it only acts in cosmological and astrophysical scale.
That's very unlikely. If it's really an abelian group and it's massless, then we would have already observed it.
Oh, it's massless.
Yeah.
Why not give it a mass?
That's what I will do. That's what I mean by breaking.
If you give it a mass, you can show it. So it may only work in lower regions.
Actually, it's the other way around. If it's massive, it will only work at very short distances. And that's what I mean by breaking the gauge group. So there will be some dynamics that will lead to a condensation of a Higgs-like scalar that will break this abelian group. It will be exactly like our Z prime, our actual Z boson. It's a neutral particle that acts at only distance scale of 10 to the minus 18 meters. Okay? So this is what I want to tell you about. Let me first, as I promised, tell you a little bit about what does it mean to have vector mediation. So what are the ingredients going into this? As I said, we need some sector that contains our standard model field. And by that I mean matter, like quarks, leptons, etc., three generations. We need a couple of Higgses. Those Higgses have to eventually break SU2 plus U1. We need all forces. We need SU2-3 plus SU2 plus U1 forces. And this would be it if we did not have this mechanism, but we already noticed that we need to break this gauge group. So I would add an additional sound model singlet, which we'll call S, which I'll show you dynamically breaks this gauge group. Okay. Now there will be additional things that I need, for example, exotics to cancel anomalies, but they're not going to play very much of a role. Okay. So this is what I mean. I need of this sector. As we said, there's going to be some vector supermultiplet that talk to these guys, meaning that every one of these fields, except for the forces, is in fact charged under this new Z prime. And there'll be some hidden sector. Now, I will not have very much to say about the hidden sector because it turns out that under some very mild assumptions, it plays no role in this entire story. And this is actually true for most mediation models. The hidden sector does not play much of a role.
Many vector fields have their own problems because they have a plantar singularity.
Right, so I will talk about that.
to the non asymptotic?
That depends on your matter content. That depends on how many fields or chars you have there. In general, I conclude that lambda fall off the one scale, and there are things falling. Don't remain a field theory anyway.
So it's not, you don't get the right scale charge.
So as I said, whether or not this guy will have a lambda fall depends on my matter content. Within the effective field theories that I will describe here, there is no such problem. There is no lambda. The gauge coupling is perturbative. You're right that if there is indeed a lambda fall up there, I have to worry about it, but within this description, there is low lambda fall. We have made sure that all of our dynamics is such that there is no coupling one can
fall. I don't see how you do that, but we'll discuss it later.
Okay. So now all that, I will need a few assumptions on this sector. The one assumption is that we need to break supersymmetry. And by that, I mean that there will be some field here that gives the fermionic partner of the gauge boson MS. So remember that for a vector supermultiplet, there is the gauge boson, which carries a spacetime index, and there is its fermionic counterpart, which is a vile fermion. So it carries now, all I'll assume is that this one becomes massive and have, as usual, a random mass. Okay? And for concreteness, I will assume that this is at 1,000 keV. So 1,000 times bigger than the electric scales. Okay? I will assume also that there are no deep turns. In other words, there are no other sources of supersymmetry breaking to that sector. Okay. This is an important assumption, and it can be easily justified. It's not very hard to construct one. So that it really does depend on your, again, your matter content. Okay? And that's it. That's the only assumption that I will have to make to generate everything that I want. The rest of this model will be completely dynamic.
But the mass, you just give it to him?
So that is part of the assumptions that is going on in this model. We know that we have models that break supersymmetry dynamically. You start with a super young Mills theory, which condenses at large distances and produces mass of the gauginos, which inevitably breaks supersymmetry. Now, if you couple this vector superfield to one of the matter content, it will break supersymmetry. It will generate a mass characteristic genome. And so, but the point is that I don't really have to say anything about it. I just have to assume that this is that. And I know that this assumption is good because I can give you a model that does it. But I really need no further. Okay, so I will therefore not talk at all about the sector. I will just assume that this is what I have. Okay? Now notice that at this point, all of these fields are massless. So I will have to generate everything dynamically. Now, how do I generate things dynamically? Well, there is quantum dynamics. All these fields feel the Higgs sector through their interactions with the Z-prime. So let's start with the scalars, the supersymmetric partners of our metaparticles. So for example, quarks. So as usual, with the noise by a line, you can have a quark exchanging a quark and the Z-prime fermion partner with another quark. This loop, if it plays two of such insertions, will generate at the quantum level a correction to the mass of this particular scalar. And the correction will go as the coupling, of course. There is a coupling constant here. But the charge of this particular scalar, we have chosen, divided by 16 pi squared, because this is a loop, so there is a volume compression. Find the mass scale, this insertion, times the log run. This is just the normal RG. It starts running where supersymmetry is broken. It runs all the way down to where the Z prime mass is. And then it stops because you have to integrate the Z prime out of your spectrum. There's no more running. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
There is no quantum divergence part here. This is the reason why it has supersymmetry.
But the supersymmetry cancel.
That's right. So there is another supersymmetry diagram to exactly cancel the quantum behavior. The quantum divergence. Good, yeah. So, and we can easily estimate this, right? Because, well, this is some large factor. It's a factor of 10. This is some order 1 number. This is a factor of 100. So overall, this mass scale will be approximately 100 GeV, maybe a little less, squared. So it will be approximately an order of magnitude below the Z prime. Now, of course, this is not the only contribution. I will write to you in a moment the other contributions, and those are important because if this is the only thing we have, we will not be able to drive any scalar tachyonic, and we will not be able to break anything. So that's not the only contribution, but this is the naive estimate, and it is correct. So unless you have some fine cancellation, that's what you want.
Right,
and that's why
that
is exactly why it can only be proportional to mz prime. Because in the limit that this goes to zero, I know that there is no correction. In the limit where this goes to zero, supersymmetry is restored, and I know there can be no correction to this mass.
Depends on the street CEV, how's that going to zero?
No, no, I'm just saying that without computing anything, I know that this must be the behavior. Of course, we have also computed that, but I know for sure this is the behavior. There is no other scale that can sit here. Because I know that when I push this parameter to zero, this entire thing will vanish because of supersymmetry. If you like, you can just do this computation and add the other diagram, which has a gauge boson around here. There are actually a few of them. And you'll find that the polaric divergence didn't exactly cancel. It must be because when this goes to zero, the supersymmetry is strong. Now, the problem is that you also have to give a mass to the forces, to the gauginos, the superpartners of the gauge particles. Now, this is a little more difficult because those guys in general don't couple to the abelian group. One abelian or another abelian group does not couple to another. So, unless one is broken. So it can only happen, let's say I have some, the gluino, for example, coming in. It can only happen at loop level. This one talks to the quarks and sparks, and those guys in turn talk to the Z prime. Now this diagram too, it's a two-loop level diagram. There is no other diagram that gives it a mass. And it will only arise the two-loop, and therefore, there is a gauge coupling from this interaction. There are also this gauge coupling, G lambda squared. There are some charges here, which don't matter all that much. Divided by a loop suppression. But this time, because there is two-loop, it's actually suppressed by a much larger factor. Okay? And again, it must vanish in the limit when z prime goes to zero, and there is a log, there's an RG log prime. And we can estimate this again. Because there is such a large suppression, and because this is linear in mass, not quadratic, this actually behaves more like 100 GeV. So this is a very generic feature of any such model. And this is the main reason why it did not be considered so far. Because the problem you run into is that most models that are considered so far really cared about the fine-tuning problems. They really wanted to have colored particles, colored scalars at very low energies to exactly cut off those quadratic divergences we talked about, but in the Higgs sector. This mechanism will not do that. You will have to fine-tune. I will show you in a second how you fine-tune, how you do it explicitly, but this is the main problem. So your Virginos will be much lighter. We'll write a spectrum in a second, but your Virginos will be much lighter than your scalars. In fact, you will never produce the scalars. And you cannot cut off quadratic divergences due to top loops, for example.
Sorry to be interrupting. Mm-hmm. So if you have a supersymmetry breaking in one CV, I don't see how the quadratic
supersymmetry is not broken in one CV.
But this is what we normally say.
Yeah. Okay, so if supersymmetry is broken,
what is the standard in LHC?
So what I claim is that you will still see at one at the LHC, you just won't see the scalars. The scalars are very heavy, you will never produce them there, I think.
Where do you break supersymmetry?
Oh, okay, good. I'm getting to that. Supersymmetry is actually broken at a very, very high scale.
Wow, so you have...
This is this. This is this guy. This is, so, thanks. So supersymmetry is broken at this scale, lambda s, which turned out in most models to be approximately 10 to the 11 GeV.
My goodness.
Okay?
I'll never see it.
You will. So that's what I'll show you, that you will see that the remnants of supersymmetry breaking. You will never see the mechanism that actually works supersymmetry, but you will see the remnants of it. Okay? Now, this is important because between this scale and the Z prime scale, there will be some RG dynamics that will generate everything we want. Okay? Due to those diagrams.
So this is related to this big simple symmetry?
That's right, so I'll comment on that next. This is in the spirit of split supersymmetry scenarios where the scalars are very heavy and only the Gaussians are very low energies. But I'll show you that in fact there is more to this than just the usual Gaussians.
So it means that we won't see supersymmetric particles in LHC.
You will. My claim is that you will. Notice where those
things are. We won't see them directly.
We will see them, well, you will let.
This is the internet.
This one is light enough to be seen. The Gaussians are light enough to be seen.
Well, if you set the supersymmetric breaking is 10 to 30 GeV.
That doesn't matter. What matters is what is the actual mass of the particle. Where is supersymmetry broken? Remember that it has to be communicated first. It has to, in this sector, is indeed broken at some very high scale. But it has to be communicated to this sector. And that communication has a large suppression. That's why those partners can be actually inferred very, very low. Okay? All right, so this is the main problem. This is why people are not considering it so much so far. But I will show you in fact that there is some non-trivial extra dynamics going on. So let me get to it. This is the generalities of vector mediation. Let me talk about RG dynamics. Remember that except for Sunni breaking, you also have to break this additional gauge group, this U1 prime or zip line. Okay? But more than that, we also have to break what we know is broken, that is the SU2 plus U1. Right? This sector of the star model, we know is broken by a Higgs mechanism. Now, whether or not there is a Higgs is a different story, but it's certainly Higgs. It's certainly in the Higgs space of the non-abelian gauge. So I will have to convince you of two things. I'll have to convince you that this model is able to produce dynamics that will create such a light Higgs, and it will break this game. Okay? So for most of these guys, the dynamics is fairly trivial. It's just embodied in these diagrams. Okay? So most of the scalars will be about their head. But we want to make sure that, for example, this one, the singlet, in fact, turns negative. The dynamics have to overshoot it around And the picture for this one, for this section, will be the scalar I'll have to show you in Google Native. So this one has to break, you won't find. But also, I have to make sure that some linear combination of these two remain light and breaks an equally symmetric. Okay. So, can everyone see Ferrari here? Okay, so let me go to the next section, and that is RG analysis. So first let me talk about the singlet sector. It's a scalar, it's coupled to the Z prime, but I need to assume some other interactions for it as well. For example, we know that in general supersymmetric models, we also the mu problem. The mu problem is the fact that these two Higgses have to get some mass, and there is no obvious mechanism that gives them the Fermion partners a mass. Okay, the Higgs cannot give itself a mass. So I will assume that the superpotential for this singlet, if you don't like the word superpotential, then the interactions of it, it interacts with the Higgses. It interacts with the Higgses with some coupling. And it also interacts with a few other exotics, which really don't matter for that model time very much. But the important point is that when this singlet will condense, this term will indeed generate the notorious mu term in supersymmetry. They will generate right the right scale to be able to fine tune the Higgs. Okay. So what are the quantum corrections to the singlet mass? Well, we already spoke of one of them. We saw that there is this diagram. But if this was all there was, this is not good enough, because this diagram gives a positive contribution to the mass. If this was all there was, there was nothing to this model. But there are other interactions. There are sort of a two-loop effect that we write in quantum anyways. That is the interaction of this scalar with, for example, the Higgses. Now, at three levels, the Higgses are massless, but really, at loop level, they also receive a mass from the same mechanism. Okay. And so you have to write a set of RGs. Now notice that this is proportional to lambda squared. Okay. You have to set up a set of RGs, and then you form dynamically and ask whether at any point can this term dominate over this term. And in fact, it's not hard to arrange that. It's very generic to have that. Of course, you can also have situations where you don't, but that's not going to be very useful. So this contribution will give it a negative contribution. So how does the dynamic look like? It's on a very high scale, the Sunni scale. Everything is massless. So we start at the origin. To begin with, we don't really have this distribution very much because the Higgsinos did not get their mass yet. So, if you plot the scalar, the singlet mass, it starts off positive. But as the RG, the quantum dynamics evolve, this term started dominating. There is, in fact, another term with the exotics, started dominating over dynamics and push it negative. Now, the hope. And what we want to achieve is that this is actually happening around this scale. Right? It doesn't have to happen exactly that scale, it can happen a little later, but it should not happen before. Because if it happens before, we will never break the gate symmetry. Okay? So this is the picture we want to achieve. This will be a negative value. Now, why is this important? This is important because we have to write the potential for this singlet. Whether it's supersymmetric or not, it has that scalar has a potential. Now we know that it has a contribution from the soft term, the mass. But there's also a different contribution. So give us a part. Now this is exactly the right kind of potential to Higgs to get a non-trivial vacuum. As long as this is positive, nothing will happen. The vacuum is around zero. So you draw the diagram. This is what you have when the mass is positive. But I just showed you that there is a possibility here for driving this scalar negative. Once this has happened, the vacuum is no longer trivial, and this singlet gets a bed, which I'll do not for now in this point on. Now, why is this good? This is good because remember that the singlet interacts with the Z5. This is how we hope to actually get a massive Z prime. And so now we have the Z prime, the actual gauge boson, coming in. And we know that it interacts with a four-point function for interaction with the Z prime with the singlet. If this was all there is, it's not, it's interesting, it's a four-point function. But because this S can receive a web, this can turn into a two-point function, a mass term for the Z prime. And we can write exactly what is this contribution. It's Gz prime squared times the charge of the singlet times this web. Okay. Now notice from here that from this equation already we can solve what is the web. Not too hard to convince ourselves that, well, there is a factor of the charge. But it goes as ms divided by gz prime us. So this is in fact nothing but a singlet mass, absolute value. This will be important in a second to make this distinction. So that's it. The z prime broken, it is now a massive gauge field. Alright? In addition, we have produced a new term. Because now the Higgsinos see this vacuum and receive their own new term from this superpotential. And this will be proportional to lambda s. So this sector is very useful. But I still have to tell you what happens to the Higgs sector. The Higgs sector is only the only other sector which is not trivial because we have to turn it negative. So I remind you that the Higgs sector is composed of up-like Higgs and down-like Higgs. This one is responsible for giving mass to the up-like quarks. This one is responsible for giving mass to the down-like quarks. And let's write, what is their mass term? At the end of the day, what's important is that at least one linear combination remains massless. So what is your mass matrix composed of? It's a 2x2 matrix because I have two of them. So the scalar equal to weight. And what is it composed of? Well, there is the Hu star Hu term that's here. And that is a soft term, which comes from the same quantum dynamics that then generated after the soft term. And as I showed you, it has a possibility of being negative. There is a D term, which gets a contribution from the bed of S. Then there is the mu term, as we just argued. And similarly on the other diagonal elements. U1, U2, U3. But in a more important way, they're also coupling between the up and down. Otherwise, there would be no mixing. If there would be no mixing, this is a disaster because we're never going to give both type quarks amounts. We need some sort of a mixing in here. It's again proportional to exactly this term over there, lambda s a q h. Okay. And the valence. This is the master, and what we hope is that there is some sort of a small eigenvalue of this master. Now, of course, it is hopeless. There will be, in general, there will be no small eigenvalue to this master. All of those scales are at 100 GeV, as we just argued. Okay? All these scales are at 100 GeV. Fortunately, this software is actually negative. So it's 100 TeV, but it's negative. So we have the possibility of trying to fine-tune this term against this term. That this term is actually much smaller than those, but it has a gauge. We have the possibility of fine-tuning the soft term against the F term. And so there's no doubt about it. There is a need for fine-tuning in this model. Now, how can you achieve fine-tuning? Since this is completely calculable, we cannot just argue some fine-tuning exists and that what gives it. Everything is calculable. We should be able to fine-tune it. We can fine-tune it by changing the supersymmetric ranking scale. And I just argued for you, where this scale is determines where this turning point is going to be. In other words, it determines what is the value of the value of S. So since these two subterms run differently under the RG, by changing the supersymmetry breaking scale, I can tune this term against this term. And this is exactly what we do. And we don't just say the word, we actually compute it. And you can write yourself a little mathematical notebook that does the fine tuning. Okay, so this is feasible. But notice a few respects here, and this turns out to be very important for phenomenology. Wait a minute, how much time do I have?
Well, we started, but we still have 20 minutes. For the breakdown problems, not the same.
Yeah.
This is a TAP program.
Where?
It says.
No, it's not helpful. It's a 4-point function. It's a graph that comes out of the coupling in the actual potential for the scalar. That looks like S star A G U X D. For example.
Two loops.
Sorry.
How can you prove it? How many numbers do you have to prove?
I cannot prove it in general. I can do a computation and show you that it does. It was not so at the beginning. What happens is that this is not really a two loop. What happens here is that you start off having no contribution from here because there is no mass to this piece at the very beginning. There is no mass because everything is zero at the supersymmetric breaking scale. But as you run down, you generate a mass here, okay? And this diagram does begin to exist. And as it exists, there are other here, okay? There is a certain other here. But you're right that your intuition leads you to the right things. There needs to be some requirement about this coupling.
Yeah.
This coupling cannot be arbitrarily small.
That's
right. So there certainly needs to be requirement on this coupling. And the requirement is that it's not too small, it's fairly close to one. Yeah. But that's pretty much it. You don't need to.
There's no fine tuning.
No, not in a mechanical sense, no. You don't need to turn it to some arbitrary body. You give it the order one coupling. But you're right, intuition does lead to the right conclusion, that it's not anything will do that. If this coupling is pretty small, it just won't do that. Just stay positive. Okay? So okay, now let's notice one curious fact about this tuning is that there is in fact an accidental tuning here. That is a result of this. The result of this large tuning is that there is an additional accidental tuning that leads to interesting phenomenology, which will hopefully distinguish these smaller parameters. So what happens? We know from this tuning that we're tuning this parameter, MHU, we need it to be roughly, almost to a very high precision, the same as this parameter. Okay? But remember from here that this then is related to the soft term, to the singlet soft term. Now, we said already that we expect this to be at 100 keV, and indeed it is. But this guy is equal to the singlet soft term divided by the gauge coupling squared and the charge. Now, this coupling front can in fact be very big, because when GZ prime is much less than 1, the inverse of it is much larger than 1. So that shows us that in fact the singlet mass is much lower than the naive expectation. Okay, about an order of magnitude lower than the naive expectation, and it's more about 10 EV or even less. Okay? So this is not something we put in. This thing came out of the other tuning to get that little whisk. And it's simply because the current of tuning is not the software. Now why is this important? This is important because of this. The gauge boson mass is given by the soft term. If it's approximately 10 TeV, maybe a little lower, it is accessible to LHC physics. Okay, now it has to be a little lower, it cannot be 10 TeV, that's not accessible, but if it's at 4 TeV, that's there, we have it. Okay, and that's what I'm going to talk about in just a second. Okay, so this accidental tuning turned out to be very important for the technology of this model. And again, notice that I had to make no further assumptions beyond this point. The model is completely dynamical. Alright, so that said, let me tell you about the large loop phenomenology. So, from so what is the Lorentz spectrum? Well, sorry. What is the spectrum in general? How does this model look like? That's what we have. At some very high scale, supersymmetry is broken. Then quantum dynamics evolved down to the fermionic partner mass, which is a distance around 10 to the 11, and to the 8 TeV. Okay, this is a 10 to the 3 TeV. Somewhere in here, there has to be a phase transition where the singlet turned negative. So this is the renormalization group scale. Somewhere along this running, the singlet has to turn negative. In here, we have, once we reach the scale, we have to integrate out the Z prime, you know. But we've already seen that most of the scalars will lie around this scale. So, for example, the sparks, the sleptons, okay? The right-handed electrons, they will all be at around 100 keV. Also, the heavy Higgs will be at around 100 GeV, because we can only fine-tune in this matrix, we can only fine-tune one eigenvalue. The other eigenvalue will still be very heavy. So the large energy will not have these two Higgs doublets. Okay? Now, somewhere in here, or maybe even here, the Higgs itself, the light Higgs, has to turn negative. And we reach the electric weak scale, where it's broken, and the gate bosons receive their mass. Okay. Now, in between, there is some intermediate scale where the Z prime gauge boson is. Distinguish between this one and this one. This is the fermionic partner. This is the honest looking gauge bosons that we hope to observe. And somewhere in here, so this is roughly 10 TeV. Somewhere in here, there is all the gauginos. The gluino, the wino, the vino. Okay, those are fermion partners that we'll see their consequences. And the rest of the time. So this is how it looks like. This is how this model looks. Now, what are the, how do we see it in, okay, let me now show you that, what kind of spectrum you can actually get. Very briefly.
Right, isn't it what you would expect also from a supersymmetry, from the usual solution to the fine-tuning problems due to supersymmetry? So I mean, those particles and those energies, more or less?
No, not at all. In usual supersymmetry, this
and entire
band is lower. This entire band of scalars is the same scale.
Yeah, but okay.
I'll show you in a moment that it makes a whole lot of difference. Whether those
guys
are there.
But let's see, I see one of the bottom ones.
Right.
And let's see, I wouldn't be able to say if it's this model or.
So I'll show you in a second. That's exactly what I'll talk about, whether this is at all distinguishable. So what have we done here? Remember at the very beginning I told you about anomalies. It's not, whenever you have an Abelian gauge group, you have to be worried that you don't have anomalies. So you have to solve a bunch of consistent conditions for the charge assignment, and at the end of the day, it turns out that there are two pretty much independent unknowns, is the charge of the left-handed quark and the charge of the hot type Higgs. This graph is really just for illustrative purposes. What it shows is the points in this parameter space where a solution exists. Okay. Now, there is some physics in that. You see, you can ask why is there no, where are there no solutions above this line. The reason is because this is the charge of the uptype Higgs. If the charge of the uptype Higgs becomes too large, there is no way, remember there is the same thing for the Higgs, there is the same sort of things for the Higgs, there is no way to cancel this diagram against this, because this diagram is proportional to Q2. If this is too large, as you pointed out, there is no way to cancel this diagram against this. So this is the reason why you have restriction on the kind of charges you can have. Okay, this is the reason why it's bounded here. This structure here is a little more solid and it doesn't carry that much information. But so this parameter space is available for us for solutions. Now how do we produce this graph? We actually took the entire set of linear RGEs, evolved them down, fine-tuned, make sure that we get the Higgs the electric weak scale without violating any bounds, or for example, without a big problem is to make sure that you don't drive any other scalar negative. The same thing drives other scalars negative as well, so you have to make sure that doesn't happen. Okay, so this is what I did. So we chose two points here, sort of distinct points, and we asked what is the low energy spectrum. So what do we see here? This is my favorite tool. So this is a spectrum of the low energy physics. This is a GeV, this is a 1000 GeV. Now, the wino is in fact most of the time the lightest guy, although this model is enough, has enough sensitivity to allow other one. This one is the singlet, the singlino, the fermionic partner of the singlino, of the singlet particle. This one is the Gluino, and sorry, this one is the Pino, and this one is the Gluino. So you see they're all at about the TeV scale. The blue line is the Gravitino. Remember, if this is really global supersymmetry, there is a fermionic partner to the graviton as well. This prediction is much less robust than the other predictions because this is assuming something about the hidden sector. But it's giving you a rough order of magnitude. Notice that it's very sensitive to the parameter space. Let me not get into it. This is not very important. Now, what we're plotting here is the spectrum versus one of the coupling, the exotic coupling. This turned out to be a very sensitive parameter because it tells us whether we can turn the singlet around or not. And up here is our golden mode, the Z prime. And notice that it's about a 10 TeV, but with this chart choice, it's actually a little heavier. This will not be observed. So in this mode, we will not observe anything but negating those. But with the other chart choice, it turns out that life is much easier. It's a very similar spectrum. Notice that the Gluino and the Bino have now flipped. The Gluino is now lighter. Again, the Gravitino and Singlino are now dominating the NSP. But more importantly, the Z prime is light enough to be observed. Okay? So now, how would we see this? How would we see this at the LHC? First of all, if the Gluino is really there, if the Gluino is that light, it will definitely produce Gluinos. Because your color, your cross section is large enough. So for example, you can have a diagram where, remember at the LHC, we are colliding a proton with another proton at 14 keV center of mass. So you have a proton coming in. This proton has gluons in it. Another proton coming in. It has gluons in it. The gluons collide to produce a H tunnel gluon. And this one will decay into two Gluinos. Okay, this has a very large cross section. Of course, there are other diagrams that participate in this, but that's essentially the picture. Now, what is the problem? The problem is that this Gluino cannot decay, at least initially. It cannot decay because it has nothing to decay to. All the quarks are very heavy, so energy conservation forbids you from decaying to quarks. So the only thing available for this Gluino is a three-body decay through an off-shell quark. So it will sit there for a while. The Gluino will sit there for a while. In fact, it really does sit because it produces almost at rest. After a little while, it will think for itself, oh, now I remember there's actually very heavy sparks, so let me utilize them and decay through one of those sparks, for example, that stop. Two stops. And some LSP. Okay? So the signature you'll see is that you'll see some event with two hemispheres with energetic hadrons. Okay, in this case maybe a top spin maybe you could observe. In other cases it could be up and down, and this will happen on both sides. Okay? Now you may be able to actually observe something very interesting because the LHC, what they can do is they know where the beams are, and they can try to reconstruct where did those tops come from. So let's imagine that they see those two tops. For top, it's going to be a little harder, but let me just take it as an example. They cannot go back and ask, did those two tops actually emerge from the interaction point? And if this Gluino sat there for a long enough time, that will not be the case. It will actually have a displaced vertex. That is known by this impact problem. The Gluino will in fact have a displaced vertex. And that will be a very strong striking signature for such an event where you have very heavy sparks and the Gluino only decays off-shell. Unfortunately, for sparks which is around 100 TeV, that is not the case. Okay? The gluino does not live long enough to leave a displaced vertex. And the LHC is able to measure a displaced vertex to approximately 10, maybe 100 micrometers. But the lifetime of this gluino is more of the order, you can do the parametrics, but it's more of the order of 10 to the minus 18 seconds. Now, this leaves it enough time to hadronize, but it will not leave a displaced vertex. Now that is interesting. What will happen is that this gluino will not just sit there, it will just start pulling out the vacuum, for example, gluons, for example, up. It will form some hadron state, some exotic hadron. It will form some, for example, a globulino, or it will pull out an up and anti-up and form some crazy meson. Okay? Unfortunately, you will not observe it directly, because it will decay before you see it. But the question is, someone was trying to answer, is whether nonetheless you can still tell that it hadronized before it decayed. And one such possibility is to look at the spin structure. Because before it hadronized, it has a precise spin content. After it hadronized, all the spin content is washed away because it's given to the light constituents. So there may be some angular correlations between those two jets that can still be observed. Okay? So this is still something we're kind of thinking about. Now, the other striking, and maybe more important for this particular model, the other striking signature is, of course, the production of the gauge boson. You see, the problem with supersymmetric particles is that if they are there, very likely they'll have some sort of a hierarchy symmetry that forbids us from reconstructing any of them. So there will always be some missing energy in the event that we will not be able to reconstruct the event in full. We will not be able to reconstruct the invariant mass of those particles. But the situation is very different with the Z prime production. I can imagine the same two protons, but instead have an up and an anti-up coming out of those two protons, generating a Z prime, which can then decay electronically. As an experimentalist, what you will see is two electrons emerging out of the event. You will take the invariant mass of the two electrons, and you form a histogram with this invariant mass. And at first, we're going to see it falling, probably coming from Z. There's also a diagram like that with a, this is a Z prime, but there's also a diagram like that with a Z, with the actual Z and a gamma star. You'll see it going down and down like phase space. But all of a sudden, at some point, you'll see a resonance. And this will be a discovery of the Z prime gauge boson. Now, this is, in fact, the one thing that would be really great to have at the LHC, because that would be a very, very clean discovery of a new particle. The sleeping will take a while, because it's hard. But if this is really there, this will just be nailed down in the very first year or two. So this would be the discovery of the Z-prime. But once you discover it, there are many more things you can do with it. You can ask whether it has any other decay channels. If it's really this model, indeed it does. Because it can be produced by the same mechanism, but it does not have to go to leptons. It can go into the singlets. Okay? The scalar singlet is, of course, very heavy, but its fermionic partner is, in fact, free life. And so, it can go into the singlet. And the singlet, again, does not have very many things to decay to. But it could, for example, decay to a Higgs and a Wino, and similarly here, a Higgs and a Wino. And this guy in turn will decay to the LSP square 5. Square square 5. This is the usual decay. This is the usual decay we'll talk about in anomaly mediation, where the winner is indeed the LSP. Now, this is hard, this may be hard to dig out, but once you know that the zip line is there, it may be easier to look for such things. Okay? If you don't know it's there, it's much harder to look for things. But if you're sure that it's there, it may be easier to look for it. This one you will not see. This is too soft to see that it's on. But the others you can see. Okay, so let me just conclude. I don't want to keep you here too long. And instead of just restating everything, so we saw this is a very dynamical model, and with very few assumptions you get very concrete predictions for the IAC. I've stated without proof that in fact it does have some very interesting range realizations. And in general it's just very calculable. That by itself is not an argument because nature does not care whether we can calculate or not. But it's easy to work with, we can make concrete statements. But let me instead conclude, let me tell you one of the shortcomings of these models and what one can work on. None of those shortcomings is at least in my instrumental. The one big one is unification in common. With this minor content, you don't have unification anymore. If you run up the copy, then you will not have unification. And this is a sad side effect because one of the favorite reasons why people like supersymmetry is exactly because cage coupling unifies so well. Second, I have not told the story of dark matter in this model. There is a dark matter candidate, but we haven't explored it yet. So maybe this is not a shortcoming, but it seems to be explored.
That's right.
So there is a stable particle here. There it is. And of course, depending on the spectrum, it may have a different identity. It could be this one, actually. Or it could be the Dragutino. There is one. It's already there. But it's not clear that this is very consistent with cosmology. It's not clear that if, you see, for example, if it's a Wino, Winos annihilate very strongly. And if you produce them in the early universe, you may annihilate too much, and you would be left with not enough dark matter. So this is one problem that this
is not a good win.
It's not a good win. But of course, this depends on many, many assumptions you're making on the early stages of the universe. Anyway, CERN, the exotic sector, is a little problematic. I have not spoken much about it. It is sort of there for the ride, but with this particular charge assignment, that exotic is stable. And it's not necessarily a disaster, but it's something that definitely has to be further explored. So, let me just conclude here and take questions.
Can you just tell me the order of magnitude of the expected masses of the singlet when it gets to its peak?
Right, so the naive estimate will be 100 TeV.
100 TeV.
Because, I think I've raised those fragments. Because the main contribution is the same as all the other scalars. Okay, it's 100 TeV. If that's the case, there is no hope, right? Because there is no way to cancel those two things. The X there will be much, much heavier. But because we demand this fine-tuning, we can think it. If it was just rising, there is nothing you can do about it. But because there is this turning around, you have the hope of fine-tuning it to be a smaller value than what you would naively expect. And this is what happens here. It actually turns out to be a little lighter than 100 TeV. It's more like 10 TeV. But That's where the fine tuning is coming into the game. There is no laboratory survey needed. And you need it to exactly the right accuracy that you would expect.
Any questions? I have one more question.
Yeah.
the stand is more of the particles that are observed.
Right.
What's the problem with the standard model? We haven't seen any.
Right, so the biggest problem with the standard model is that, like it or not, if you scatter W bosons together, the longitudinal modes grow strong at about the TeV.
Maybe not.
Well, they certainly do within the context of quantum field theory. If within the context of quantum field theory, you're certainly violating unitarity at that stage. Now, if you want to go extremely crazy, say that maybe something, some new quantum mechanics is going on, there is no violation of unitarity, maybe we'll come up with a model. It's pretty hard.
But in the standard model, the heat exchange cancels.
Right. So, so, so. Exactly. So, so. Right.
Not a problem.
No, that's exactly right. But we're asking you to have an actual Higgs particle, a scalar,
okay,
sitting.
Okay, Higgs particle.
Right. Okay. So
if you have a Higgs, you have a hierarchy problem.
Right.
Because of the quadratic
divergence.
Right. So what buy into all this, because you're taking a lot of low particles.
Right.
See.
Yeah.
What do I get into my bank credit?
That's a good question.
In
the low energy point of view, it seems like I've not gained very much. I still have fine-tuning problems. But, right. But from the high energy point of view, this seems a very likely scenario. Because it's very easy to get abelian gauge groups, and it's very easy to get supersymmetry. So, as I said at the very beginning, this is not the usual motivation. I'm not trying to from low energy to motivate why we should be fine-tuning. If you don't like this motivation, you can say, the heck with this model, I don't care about it. It's not something that fits within my philosophy of how nature should be. But even said that, you should not ignore the possibility that the signatures of this model are very striking and it is testable. So within a few years, we will know whether this model is right or wrong. It's not something that I can wave my hands around and say, well, but maybe if we don't see that. Within 2 years, we will know whether it's the right model.
The problem with the LHC is to find the same type.
Right.
27 people have gone from running, so they have to serve and say, I have a Z, but
that's right.
Have a different model.
Well, but we'll know something fundamentally new about the universe, that there is a fifth force. So forget about all the credit, where the credit has to go. There is a, we discovered something really big.
Can you distinguish, I guess you can distinguish this model from one that has only an extra U1.
So if indeed you see the supersymmetric particle,
right,
that would be a very striking signature for what's going on. And if you ask that whether this is the right model, then you have to discover this guy.
My former advisor, Dan Bernstein, student, Sampiansky, they published a small paper on like possible signatures of an extra U1, also motivated by spin theory, because it's like the generic thing.
Right.
So it has that, you know, you see the resonance of the C prime, but then you don't have all, because their model's not supersymmetric at all.
Right.
It's just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so U1 prime have been around for many, many, many years. The simplest models of unification, SL10, gives you U1 prime.
You have to observe the other guys to sort of this thing.
Yeah. But, you know, the hell with credit, this will be an amazing thing to discover. We have a new force in nature. So we'll figure out the details later on. That by itself will, the day we discover it, we'll have a linear collider.
That's a little long time.
Yeah. Not that long. If it's really discovered, they may start building
you
up.
You just have to convince Bill Gates. Or some other.
That's right. Well, you guys have another one.
Any other questions? Thank you.